I wanted to share some more reflections. Please feel free to take them up to your hearts if they resonate. And if they really don't, sometimes you can just let them pass by. What's not, you know, resonant. I don't have the truth on anything, so please feel free to just let it pass you by. And maybe sometime later there will be, yeah, that's what Noon was talking about. And maybe not. It's not, you know. What we hear, it's also quite subjective to our own experience and all of this. And where we're at. So I wanted to speak a bit more on belonging and mention someone called Brené Brown, who does some great TED Talks and has written books and that on this subject. You can look her up. We'll put her on the book list, hey? Because she's so cool. And she says something really that's been very helpful for me, and that is, if you look for non-belonging, the world will constantly confirm that to you. It will be very easy to find the reasons why you don't belong. So changing the programming is looking towards where we do belong. From that, so easy to fall into. You see, I don't belong. Well, I'll just throw myself out in the cold bin, you know. So that, changing that, looking for, I'm the outsider. It's something to be to keep an eye on, how quickly that can get confirmed. So we don't need to look for that. We can look for belonging. I wanted to say more on to go a little bit more into non-self, which is kind of like belonging as well. In a funny way. And one way of looking at it is to think about a car. So you have a car that has has seats and seat belts and steering wheel and lights and wheels and motor and different things in the motor, all of this. And if you look for, well, where is car? You know, you can't actually find car in the wheels of the car, no? The wheels are themselves, a hub, a tire, some air, some inner tube, you know, all of this. You can't actually find the inherent existence of car in its parts. And yet it functions as something that we call car. It's a vehicle. And it gets us from A to B. So it doesn't exist within its parts. And if we just imagine for a second that those different parts are our conditionings, are our downloads, we don't exist within one of those, but the whole makes an entity. And so we, as the car needs all its parts to go along, with just three wheels, kind of falls in the ditch. In that same way, you know, we do need a self to function. Otherwise, you know, if we don't have a name or anything, so hey, you, you know, we need a name. We need, you know, certain aspects that can be seen through as names and etc. But we need to function as a self, like, you know. And that's where it can feel quite tricky, all of this self and non-self, and how we do need to be a self to function in this world, in this, with the other human beings and the other beings. We need that. And another way of saying it is from, what's his name? I can't remember his name right now. Oh, yeah, Ken Wilber. Ken Wilber. Is, say, like, in the ocean, there's loads of waves. And each wave is completely unique, no? If you sit and you watch the sea, every single wave is totally different. They're all wonderfully unique. And yet each wave is wet and salty. And in this way, we are also just, we are all waves. We're all beings in that way. We're wet and salty, but unique as well. But we're actually all part of that big ocean. And that's a sort of way into non-self, is that we're all part of this ocean, and yet we're all unique with this quality of wet and salty, frothy on top. Another way of looking at it, that really, really, after years of trying to understand this, this comes from Adyashanti, who's a spiritual guide in America. And I don't so much get on with his books, but there's just one line that just like, oh yes, it really helped me to understand. And that is, he's saying that, like, when we have an emotion, we kind of file it under me, you know? So as if we were on the computer and we go, oh, here comes emotion, put that in the file, me. So we keep attributing what's passing through us as me-ness to strengthen the sense of me, to solidify that me-ness. And that's not so helpful for the unsticking, for things not to stick inside us, that filing. And it's not so easy to actually feel, because it's so flittering, you know? It goes through so fast, that habit of an emotion, and straight away we're possessing it into the me-ness of it, that we've already consolidated that I am, whatever emotion is happening now, or thought, or, you know, sensation, or whatever. Whereas staying with that movement as we begin to file it, we can feel the impermanence of it, actually. But it's a tricky, tricky, fishy one, you know? I really invite you to try to check that out, because it's quite good fun to play that. What we're doing, how we're integrating emotions into that meanness, which is of course really different from repressing, pushing away emotions, you know what I mean? Like to actually welcome and to go inside an emotion to see what their nature is very different from filing under meanness. And then we become more and more familiar with, I am that emotion. And it just ain't like that. And where I've really noticed in a experiential way how much we need to have a self to be able to walk around and live our lives here is sometimes I've done care work in the last 4 or 5 years. I'm working with someone with Alzheimer's, being my client, very, very advanced Alzheimer's, where the person actually loses all sense of self and the functionalities go and that. And there you go, oh no, we do need a sense of self, you know, to know that I am getting the food and it's got to go to my mouth, you know. And then when a person is going, but is that me or is that you, that arm? And you're like, no, that's me and that's you. But they've lost that sense of me, and so they can get really lost, and there I'm like, oh yeah, we really need a self to function. And then the Buddhist teachings on non-self are about the grasping of self, which is different. It's a very different thing, that to how much we're gripping tightly and believing in that being very solid, as opposed to something more fluid, the waves in the ocean that move, they come up, they come down. So in this Heart Sutra that Sumedha was speaking of yesterday, I'll just say a little bit more what she was saying, because it's such a good one, that. And form is formless, / emptiness. Emptiness is form, or the formless is form. Form as in, you know, us, body, shape, here, taking up this space. The Dalai Lama says, the existence of things and events is not in dispute. It is the manner in which they exist that must be clarified. No being or thing exists independently of other beings and things. So as Sumedha was saying, we are our context. Hey, each one of us is coming from a context of being born from this family with this mum and this dad, and are now at this age, in this place, in this town, or village, or, you know, with this education, with this talent, with this job, with this, you know, we are those, that context of us and the world. We're not just independently me on my own, just being a noon, you know, it doesn't work like that. There are conditions that have a lot of stories and conditions that have come about for me to be sitting here now, and for you to be sitting there, and for you there, and you know what I mean? In this place, a lot of conditions. There were stonemasons, you know, who built this place. There were people who built the road for us to get here. There were people who cooked the food and grew the food for us to eat. 20 years ago as well. Okay? The vegetables we ate 20 years ago. So it's this constant web of interactionality with other beings in action. It's quite amazing. And to continue with the Dalai Lama, the distress comes from believing ourselves to be independently existing beings with an intrinsic self. Perceiving this as illusion liberates us from suffering. So there's that freedom when we're no longer believing that we come into existence and that we exist independently of others. Influence, vegetables, road making, cloth making, you know, education, thoughts, films we've seen. It's endless. And there's this feeling in, as we have in meditation, maybe sometimes things have dropped down and the thoughts have dropped away and the sensations and feelings have calmed down. And then there's that feeling of largeness, like a widening, like whereas, you know, as wide as the universe, or just something more space, you know. That spaciousness when all those conditions just calm down a bit. Our conditioning, our conditions of arriving here and being, all that just chills out a bit, quietens down. And then there's space for that larger reality. And it in Tibetan Buddhism, at least, it's said that is, they call that ultimate truth. And then there's relative truth, which is that, yes, you know, I am an English-speaking person who is 51 years old, etc., 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 etc. You know, that's my relative truth. And I do live in France. I really do. It's not, you know, it's not fantasy, that. And as the Dalai Lama, I'm quoting him again, is they are not, that one is a truth and the other is a lie. That, you know, that conventional reality is the lie and ultimate truth is the real reality that we need to head to. It's that they are both truths. The two of them are true. And that's sometimes the bit that we struggle with. That the two are true truths. And a lot of the time, you know, you could say, I will dare to say, that the spiritual path is very much the dance of those two. Like this. The dance of that larger reality that's much, much bigger than ourselves and our conventional reality of who we are. And how we relate and deal with that dance, how we dance. This is the spiritual path. And sometimes we could get much, much more involved with the larger feelings of being as big as the universe and the freedom that comes from that, you know, of being with the divine, tapping into that. And sometimes it's really appropriate to be working with the conventional reality. And then there's that relationship between the two. And we're jumping from this to that to, the relationship between the two. So that we're not getting nihilistic and going off onto a, like, kind of transcending trip where we're just so far out that, we don't deal with reality, everyday stuff, you know, because we think we're above it all. And then, you know, we know the stories, don't we, of spiritual guides getting out there and thinking they're beyond doing the washing up. You know, they start to not be very grounded and weird stuff happens. And we're really, you know, we're really impacted by how we perceive ourselves, and how we are perceived. You know, to come into that conventional reality. Those are big parts of our lives, not to be brushed away, not to be dismissed as important. And I've been reading this book by this scientist called Cordelia Fine. She's an Australian scientist who's won an award, I think, for this book. One of them is called Testosterone Rex. It's about the kind of dispelling the myths of the power of testosterone hormones and stuff like that. But she's a lot about gender stuff. And so she's looked a lot into different scientific studies that have been done. And for example, one of the studies was, they've taken a bunch of students who were studying maths and said, okay, and they're men and women, and we're going to test you to see, your level of mathematics, to check out. So they're telling them before it starts the test that the test is to see the difference between men and women's capacities with maths. And the fact that they say that before the test actually influenced the results of the tests. because a lot of women are living under the bias in their minds that women aren't as good at maths. And actually they're studying maths and they're really good at maths. But when they say that before the test, it really changes the results and they can't think properly. And then they've done a lot of this type of testing, even with the environment, the room, you know, like with computer programmers. And they say, this is a test to see the differences between how male and female brains work with computer programming. And in the room, they set it up with kind of geeky stuff and Star Trek posters and, you know, technical manuals and stuff like that. And the women aren't as good at it. And then they do the same test in a room that's kind of neutral. And the women are much better at it. And they do the same thing with kind of language literature tests with men and women, saying, so we're testing to see if it's really true that men aren't as good at languages. Mm-hmm. And when they say that before the test, the men don't do so well. Mm. And that's like, wow, the power of our perception of ourselves, you know. And they've done a lot of these tests with different minorities. To see how it is when you tell a minority group that that's what you're testing about, how that, you know, influences how our brain works. And it doesn't work as well. When we feel like a minority, something, you know, we need to be able to do a test and have all of our brain working. We need to feel relaxed, you know. And so those are really interesting studies I find to read about how that perception can be influenced just by a few sentences. And like, I was listening to a thing recently by a guy called John Corvino. And he's speaking quite a lot about homosexuality and perceptions of that. And and he's saying, like, so often in the media, you would read a homosexual man molested a child, da-di-da-di-da-di-da, you know? And everyone just takes that in, drinks it in without, you know, which leads to certain assumptions. Whereas if a heterosexual man molests a child, they don't say a heterosexual man molested a child. They just say a man, you know? And the fact of saying a homosexual man molested a child builds up this bias in people's minds. Homosexual men are child molesters, you know? Like that, boom, through the media, direct. And these are really interesting to see what the impacts of conventional realities on us, and to get to know each other a little bit more, to maybe understand each other a bit more of where we're coming from. I've been looking into this subject for quite a while. I know it's a sensitive subject. But like I read some time ago, maybe when I was studying baccalaureate, about migrants to America. And you know how so many different migrant groups have arrived to try their luck out. You know, normally poor people, like it's arriving now in Europe by boatloads, swimming across the ocean, you know, all this exactly like it is now. You know, in the last 50 years in America, there have been waves of migrants. And how they've behaved is that somebody who gets there will look for, you know, a Polish person will look for the Polish community. Mm-hmm. And a Sicilian, an Irish, you know, Eastern Bloc. People will look for that because someone there, you know, could be a cousin of a cousin and say, look, you know, okay, so you're an illegal. First, just stay with us for a bit, and then, if, you know, maybe we can get you an illegal job, and you know, and they've studied this ghettoization phenomena and how people behave, and as soon as people feel secure, they're ready to open out to the other people. They come out of their ghettos and get to know more than just their own, where they arrived to, which was the security. And that's, I find that really fascinating, how we behave like that. And I've actually felt that a lot, because I've travelled a lot and lived in a lot of different cities. And I felt how the people that I've made friends with have always been, because I've been the newbie arriving, who doesn't have a circle of friends, you know. And the people who are quite sure in their social lives, well, they're like, well, you know, not so open to making new friends always. But the other immigrants, new arrivals and people on the outsides, they're open because they don't have a security of social life. So I've gone, how come I've got all the friends and all the immigrants and the outcasts? And I noticed this very strongly in Toulouse, a city in the south of France, where there, like 20 years ago, back in days when I was young, I used to go to this lesbian bar, and it was down a dark alley, you know, almost in the suburbs, in a place without a sign outside. It was really hidden, you know. And you would go there, and no one would speak to you because you knew. And they were like, you're a stranger, you know. And everybody looked a bit the same, and it was quite closed, actually. And I had that same feeling of this is the women here are so insecure in being gay women that they've really hidden away. They've hidden away in a real back street, you know. They haven't been able to be proud to be there. They've had to go underground, and it felt sad, and it felt sad how closed it was. And then things moved on, and someone else opened up a bar, and someone else opened up a bar. Now there's 3, 4, 5 different lesbian places, and some mixed, and some queer, and some, you know, all sorts. And everybody's walking around a bit more proud, and, you know, having some dignity about who they are. And that's nice to see, that they've found some security. They don't feel quite so menaced that they have to actually go underground, you know, into a basement, you know, and hide. So these are really strong impacts of people feeling threatened, you know, of not feeling quite welcome in who you are. You know, it can be a little bit, some lives are a bit more difficult than others, you know, just a little bit more difficult. And like Bob Marley says it like that, yeah, just a little bit of trouble, you know, a little bit of trouble. And so understanding that some people have just had a little bit more trouble, and that makes them more defensive sometimes. Like they have a little bit more something to defend of themselves. And there's a reason for that. It's like that immigrant who's just arrived, you know. They're not sure if they're allowed to be. They're not sure if they're welcome always. And that work, it's a big work for us to work through, you know, our strangeness. Hey, I'm not part of the dominant culture, the mainstream culture. It's, you know, it's a big thing to work through, and that's a, for me, that's a really important part of spiritual practice for all of us. To be understanding what someone else has been, a little bit of trouble, you know, they may have been going through, to just to exist, just to be able to be themselves. and the sensitivities there may be there around that. And how, you know, to develop compassion, we really need to know what our privilege is, to be aware of our privilege. And then we could stop behaving from privilege that may be oppressing someone, you know. There's the wonderful Tibetan practice, Tibet that's full of mountains, hey, Himalayas. And that is, you know, this is ancient practice, and that is come down from your mountain. It means, you know, from the mountain of your ego, basically. Come down from your mountain and go up the other person's mountain to meet them. Mm-hmm. To meet who is the other. So that we're not separating so much, you know. To get to know the other. To get to know what feels strange to us. And what I've heard a lot, especially recently, you know, as a transsexual myself, what I've heard a lot is being mirrored back to me is, but why do you need to say it? You know what you are, and it's like, well, I think it happens for the whole spectrum of LGBTQI, whatever. You know, like somebody on the more mainstream spectrum, like, for example, heterosexual, will speak about their lives and their relationships and all of that, and that's just normal. And if you, as a minority, speak about it, it's like, why are you flaunting it? Why do you have to talk about it? Why do you have to say you're that, you know? Why do you have to make a point about it? But actually, you're just doing what everyone else is doing. Mm. So people would rather that you shut up about it. And I find it wonderful that at the moment we're in this sort of, we're in this crazy phase of breaking out, you know, of there just being kind of two options, you know. And there's a lot, there's 76 genders, you know. And a lot of people are going, what's going on, you know? But we thought that there was kind of two genders, male, female, and then a little gang of weirdos, you know? But actually we're finding out now that actually the human race is pretty diverse, you know? And there's this kind of binary male, female, and then there's... And there's a lot more than what we think, actually. You know, there's a lot more people who feel a bit something else, you know. There's a lot more intersex people actually born like that. There's a lot of people who would be, you know, on their passport it says male, but actually their chromosomes are female, you know. They're discovering a lot scientifically that, you know, you can have the genitals of one sex, but a lot of other bits aren't, you know. They're from something else. And that's fascinating that all of those studies are coming out and getting shared now. So that, you know, we're a real carnival, actually. And that's far out that is finally being, a bit more appreciated and spoken of, so that people can feel a bit safer and we can really, you know, move into a bit more compassion about it, or a bit more understanding of each other. And we can really that's for me the great irony of these non-self teachings, is how the form can just fit wonderfully and swim in the formless. How from a sense of groundedness we can manifest as we wish to be. We can allow ourselves to be who we want to be. They're still trying to. There's still some difficulty, a little bit of trouble, you know. We're trying to work this out. For example, like for me to get hormones, to get male hormones, I have to go and see a psychiatrist, you know. Because it's deemed I'm not responsible enough to decide that on my own. But to drive a moped, you don't need to see a psychiatrist. you see those youngsters on mobilettes on a Saturday night and they've been drinking. You know, so many times I've driven past and stopped the car because you see a moped on the floor and they've crashed. And, you know, it's like, who allows those 14-year-olds to drive mopeds on alcohol, you know? Without seeing a psychiatrist. There's all sorts of crazy shit going on where we don't need to see a psychiatrist, you know. That people are at 14, you're deemed responsible enough to be able to drive a moped. It's like, whew, yeah. I have some quotes from James Baldwin. Have you heard of James Baldwin? He was an American writer in the 70s. He was black and gay, and he's a brilliant writer, was a brilliant writer, really, really good. Quite controversial at the time, and he really supported Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and all of this. He was right behind them. And he was writing about them. He was writing a book about them when he died. I don't think he got shot, though, which the rest of them did, for speaking out, hey. And for speaking about black rights and that. So he's speaking, I think, from the point of view in the middle of the civil rights movement in America for black people to get the right to vote, to, you know, just really basic rights that they had to really fight for. And he's also, as a gay man, speaking from that point of view. But he says, he's speaking of the dominant culture, the mainstream. You never had to look at me. I had to look at you. I know more about you than you know about me. Not everything is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. This is another quote. The question is really a kind of apathy and ignorance, which is the price we pay for segregation. That's what segregation means. You don't know what's happening on the other side of the wall because you don't want to know. So it's quite radical stuff, hey? It's quite strong. Should I read it again, or should I read that at the end or something?
You can read it again.
Yeah. All right. Says, you never had to look at me. I had to look at you. I know more about you than you know about me. Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. The question is really a kind of apathy and ignorance, which is the price we pay for segregation. That's what segregation means. You don't know what's happening on the other side of the wall because you don't want to know. And so we come come around to Nelson Mandela, who I'll paraphrase it, but he was like, well, until we're all free, you know, we need to let go of our privilege and stop oppressing, and then we can all be free. But you can't be free without, as long as some people are still oppressed. That was his enlightenment. And if we only, if we just were in that practice of, I just accept everything, just let everything just happen, without the, sometimes the need to stand in our place, sometimes to stand strong, and sometimes to say it strong and clear, there would still be slavery. There would still be child labor. There would be no abortion, So, I'm speaking here of how to manifest the form, but coming from the formless, which is a wider receptacle. And maybe more balanced and equanimous. In where we choose where to stand up strong, or where to battle, where to be activist, to come from that wider ocean. And to really, if we can, be looking out for our mutualities, where we share something, to see where there's that connection we can... Say, hey, we're the same. Our reciprocities are interdependence. To really grow big roots out to those interdependencies. Like I hear that I've seen the film about trees, I don't know if you have, where they're speaking of how trees have fungi that grow over hundreds of acres, and those fungi are in symbiosis with the trees, and their communication systems, they're like the Wi-Fi, and the trees are telling trees like miles away over there that there's something, some disease there, or some insect that's not helpful, and so we need to bring out some bitter juices so that the insect doesn't get us all. And there's these incredible systems in nature of reciprocities, of mutual help and understanding. And that's really nature can really help us so much in that, in understanding each other and coming down from our mountain and going to visit someone else's mountain. And I wanted to just offer a last bit as part of this retreat is coming to an end, and part of what we've been sharing this whole week, and that is the practice of noticing cessation is can be so fruitful And it's a bit like when you live in a caravan, you notice that a bad weather day actually has a lot more moments of sunlight and nice bits than when you're in a big house. Maybe you've noticed that here whilst doing walking meditation, you know. Oh, rainy day today, I'm not going out at all. And then, oh, you know, actually it stopped. And just for the walking meditation it stops. And actually it's sunny and, you know, and this ways. And with our mind moods and our feelings and desires and aversions and all of that, with this growing and cultivation of awareness, we can notice the moments when there is no delusions, you know, when there is no grasping in the mind. And those moments are really, they're like, ah, between the clouds, you know, the blue sky between the clouds. Oh, there's some blue sky there, you know. And you can start off the day and you can be in a real tiz about something. You know, you can have a real bee in your bonnet and you could keep going with that all day. Or you could look out for the space and then get into the space when that's not got a grip on you. And then you could grow it a bit, that, you know, becoming familiar with cessation when the delusions are not happening, with a clear mind, becoming more and more familiar with that. It helps us to recognize it when it's there and then to expand that muscle. To stretch that, you know, through familiarity, through knowing cessation, we can get way more familiar with our non-deluded mind without expecting instant enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And there will be storms. It's part of the human experience, is the storms going through the mind. But those moments of, you know, as we were saying, you know, awakening, those moments are there. And that, like the babies, that the beginnings are, oh, wow, there's no anger in my mind, there's no tension, there's no grasping. What does that feel like? So that we're changing the programming from being into our delusions and trying to get rid of our delusions, trying to get rid of these things in our mind that shouldn't be there. When they're not there, we notice and go, oh, yes, yes. Let's have tea, let's have a party. This is one of my favourite poems from Rumi. It's called The Silkworm. I stood before a silkworm one day, and that night my heart said to me, I can do things like that. I can spin skies. I can be woven into love that can bring warmth to people. I can be soft against a crying face. I can be wings that lift, and I can travel on my 1,000 feet throughout the earth, my sacks filled with the sacred. And I replied to my heart, dear, can you really do all those things? And it just nodded, yes, in silence. And so we began and will never cease. So we have like 10 minutes or something if people want to share anything that's, you know, that's resonated, that hasn't resonated, that's whatever. Now's the moment if you feel like that. And And even if this talk has brings something up later, today, tomorrow, next week, get in touch and tell us about it somehow. Or tell us tomorrow or before we leave, or, you know, or write an email or something like that. Things don't have to, you know, sometimes things take a while to through us, you know. And sometimes it comes a bit later. Dan was going to say something, but...
I just wanted to share how cool my family is, because my husband gave birth to our child. We got married, we're both transgender, and not only were we able to have male passports and driving licenses and stuff, not able were we able to get married as two men together, but as two trans men together, all legally, and that's just changed so much since when I was at university and I was involved in so many protests and stuff. Yeah. So I just think that's pretty cool. Yeah. Not relevant to Buddhism, but cool.
Maybe relevant to an opening world. No? Thank you. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask about the apathy and delusion in terms of awakening and the men who run the Thai forest lineage that you've been part of. Does that suggest that they're, you know, there's not awakening there, and is it running in the wrong direction?
I think we could say that there are blind spots, you know, and that somebody can have a lot of awakening and have a big blind spot. And that some people may not want to recognize how big that blind spot is. And that doesn't mean that that person hasn't been an incredible conduit for sharing Dharma that has really changed a lot of people's lives. So the Dharma has been coming through that man. But the issues with the woman, I hope in this life that he will deal with them. But maybe not, you know.
How do we go about making sure we recognize our own blind spots?
That's a really good question. Yeah, I'm trying to work that out myself. Because it's so difficult. Hey, and that's why they're blind. Hey, because we can't see them. That is the difficult bit, hey. I don't know. I think I'm still sitting with that one, actually.
I think just as an answer to that, I think that's why community is so important.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that you can't really tell about yourself until somebody opens your eyes and tells you what you're doing and how, and then you start to think about it and why you do it. And,
yeah.
Blind spot might open.
Sorry?
Jar is window.
Sorry?
Jar is window. It's like a process.
Yeah.
Where you sort of, you can see yourself this way. This side, you can't see yourself, mm-hmm. and that's the Jahari's window.
Jahari's window.
Mm-hmm. So they will give you insight mm-hmm. in how they view you.
And that's the others?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think what you said about climbing the other person's mountain is really important. So it's like when we get stuck in our own position, and we can't anymore resonate or empathize, or, you know, we're like, well, why have you got to, you know? Why are you, you know, why are you wanting to speak about what you're wanting to speak about? You know, it's like instead of actually trying to listen into that person's reality, it's like that's a real sign that we're closing down. So I think noticing that and noticing where we're going, all right, I don't want to be threatened actually in my comfortable position. So I'm spiritual, please don't threaten me. it's classic, isn't it? So we actually have to keep the kind of knife going, the kind of spiritual knife cutting us through. So.
But yeah, I do find that for myself, if if a few different people give me the same feedback, I'm like, I need to consider this. I really need to consider this. Is there truth in that, you know? to take on, and to invite feedback as well from people is a pretty good way. And then you have to sift through, you know, as well, what's real and what could be some sort of projection, you know, to not always take on other people's projections, but to try and find what resonates as true in what that person is feeding back to me. And I think experiences that keep coming back and tripping us up, that's often a sign of a blind spot, no? So we go, I've been here before, oh, and it hurts. It must be that. But I'm certainly, I'm on this question. I'm just not fully finished, you know? Sometimes I like things to hang out in outer orbits of awareness, you know? And they're working. They're working out there on Pluto, on Mars and everything, you know? And then when they're ready, they'll come in, you know? Thank you. I think Ali wanted to say something.
Well, it's a related question. I mean, do you have any thoughts on why there's been so many scandals in Buddhism recently? Do you think it's this kind of insularity of Dharma teachers? There seems to be a lot of kind of sexual scandals coming in.
I think that it's not that it's insular, that it's de-insularizing. It's that people are becoming brave enough to speak out. Mm. People are finally going, that's enough of abuse from gurus.
Do you think this has been going on for like millennia, basically, in a certain kind of...
Yeah, I think there's been a lot has been going on. But maybe there's something in Buddhism coming to the West as well, where there's some bits have been left behind, maybe. Where, like with Tibetan Buddhism, you really, part of the practice is offering your trust to the guru, and that eventually you realize that the teacher is the teacher inside yourself, and that person is just mirroring that. Your own spiritual guide within yourself. But you do all these rituals and the spiritual guide melting into your own, coming into your heart and the spiritual guide and the spiritual guide. And so it's all about this trust. The spiritual guide says, do this, you're supposed to kind of do it. But when it's come over to the West, the discernment factor has sometimes been left behind. Where it's like, yeah, but if he tells me to jump off the cliff, no. Or if he tells me to sleep with him, no. You know, then. So we've lost a little bit in translation, maybe, that has permitted something weird to happen. Possibly, I don't know.
I also think there's something that's in the teaching. It's dangerous in the teaching position because it's like if people are really listening to you, really giving you credibility, and suddenly you feel like, oh well, obviously I have, you know. It's like, and that isn't, and there isn't a reflection of you need to be careful with that from within the system, which is tend to be what happens when you create a group, and there's a teacher, and the group wants to listen to the teacher. There isn't a reflection actually, you know, is the teacher. Can we keep trusting the teacher, you know? Whereas the Buddha said you have to live with a teacher for like at 12 least years. 12 years before you really trust them, you know? So it's like there needs to be a kind of awake feedback mechanism, I think, with the teaching position, because as soon as there's power, that leads to a lot of delusion. Mm. It can lead to a lot of delusion. And so you need to be really careful with that dynamic as... You know, the people who are teaching, but also in receiving teachings, it's like keep your lights on as well.
Yeah.
Like
Sumedha was saying about the temple, you know, where I could hear that. And I was like, but surely most of us in this temple can hear that people are breaking in. Mm. So somehow we turned our lights off a bit, you know. Mm. I need to get up, you know.
Yeah. And this can be a real thing about authenticity. So when the thing happened around the misogyny in the tradition I was in, there was a lot of people who it was too... I mean, I can't judge it at all, but there were people who articulated that their relationship with the teacher was more important to them than anything else. So even if that teacher was doing something that seemed to be harmful, they didn't want to question that relationship. It was a deep disloyalty. It would have been spiritually cataclysmic, etc. So some people were willing to question, and some people that relationship felt too important. Whereas for me, it was like the teaching is really important. But if the person is acting in a deluded way, then, you know, I want to take the teaching and keep putting that into practice. Without, you know, it's like I still have a lot of respect for Ajahn Sumedho, but I also feel really clear, you know, that was, I don't know, I think that was deluded. So,
Can we have one last one for the road? Because I know that Linda needs to share as well about some practicalities and the time. We're a little bit over the time, so could we have one last one?
I wanted to ask, you spoke about transcendence, like people like going into like far out transcendence.
Yeah.
And the other day you made a talk about the importance of eating and nourishment, and I was wondering what the Buddhist views on fasting, and also what your views on like breatharians and people who think that like they can look at the sun and get fed up with that.
Well, on breatharians, I would say I've had the experience of being so deep inside calm that it feels like everything is slowed down. So my heart, I don't need to breathe very much. I hardly need to breathe. Hasn't happened for a while, I have to say. But and then I've gone, oh, wow, this is what they're talking about. Where you don't, because you're not breathing very much, you don't need to dispense any energy, and your heart's just really calmed down and everything. So I can understand that some people can hardly need any food. I don't understand how people cannot need any food. I don't get that. But some people get really, so the system is hardly needing anything from outside. I've heard that crocodiles, they have four aortas, you know? You know, the
valve.
What?
The valve in the heart.
The valve to the heart. And that they can go underwater for a long time because they have a mechanism, because they're like, whoa, so aware with their valves, that they can just get into an aware state and they can shut down three valves. So that their heart beats so slowly that they can go under the water for quite a long time without needing to come up for oxygen, because they're on low stuff, you know? And then they gobble you up in their cave.
And do Buddhists fast?
Yeah, there is a practice. There's a Tibetan practice of fasting that I've done, actually. It's really good fun. And you do it in the springtime normally for 2 or 3 days, and you do prostrations. So all day long you do prostrations and then just meditation, lying down, and then 40 minutes prostrations, and you don't eat. Like the first day, it's like the long bows, you know, when you stretch out like that and come back up and stretch out and come back out. And you do that for 2-3 days, but it's kind of like the first day you've had breakfast. And the second day you can still drink, and the third day you don't drink or eat. And some people do it for, I think, longer than 3 days. But it's a really far out practice, because I was convinced that the physical effort would mean that I would be keeling over from lack of food. But it was actually okay. It was really, really nice. It felt really like I was cleansing. And apart from that, I have very little attraction to fasting. Myself. I don't know about it because I haven't done it much, so I can't really say much. I do often feel like just eating a very light supper. And that feels good to me. Thank you. Thank you for being part so interdependently in this talk.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.